Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello and welcome to episode 30 of Dogcast Radio. In today's programme, we have an interview with Dr. David Smith about research contrasting the intelligence of crossbreeds and pedigrees.
Yeah, we almost split up a few marriages where the wife had a purebred and the husband had a crossbred, and we were trying to prove which one was the best.
We have two-minute fiction about a dog with a problem.
Leon Burgess is supposed to love the water, but Charlie can't stand it. He tries, he paddles tentatively, running away quickly if the slightest wave of water approaches him. But he won't let the water get higher than his lower legs, and he will definitely never swim.
And the Dogcast Radio news team presents a special report on the strange things some dogs eat.
A six-month-old Labrador puppy recently found himself well and truly in the doghouse when he chomped through 800 pounds.
But before all that, we have an interview with Peter Farrell about the fantastic work being done by the charity Dogs Only, which is based in the Little Rock and Central Arkansas area. First of all, I asked Peter to tell me just what Dogs Only is.
Dogs Only is a rescue, rehab and rehome organisation. It's a small rescue group. It's very similar to a lot of the humane societies that exist across the United States, and it's comprised of volunteers who give up their time in order to bring dogs in from the community, take dogs from families who are no longer able to keep them, or bring them in from pounds where they're facing euthanasia. And we'll rehab those dogs, keep them in foster, spend some time to train them, deal with any issues they might have, and prepare them then to go out to a new life with permanent adopters.
Mm. And what's the area that you cover?
By and large, we cover central Arkansas, which is the south central part of the United States. But we do take a lot of animals in from other parts of the country. We'll get requests from other organizations, for example, that might not be able to take large dogs. So they'll transport those across the country to us. And then, of course, we get a lot of adoption requests from all over the United States. And when that happens and we're able to identify a good home, there are ways for us to transport those dogs anywhere in the U.S.
So anybody in the U.S. can talk to you or access your website and have a look at the dogs that you've got then?
That's right. Of course, it's on the Internet. It's available worldwide. And one of our other goals, one of our other missions, is also to provide education.
Mm.
So if you look at the Dogs Only website, the most important part of the website to us is the adoption gallery, but it's littered with all sorts of educational materials to talk about health issues, behavioral issues, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to make this information available, but of course, in the course of people looking at the site, we'll often get people who might be from 1,000 miles away who find one of our dogs in the adoption gallery and want to adopt. Now, when that happens, we can get with a rescue group in their area and arrange for a home visit, counseling, and an interview. And if after all of that process, it's decided that the adoption should go forward, we've got a number of ways then that we can safely transport that dog to that family. We can either use volunteers who will each take a section of the journey. It's a lot of fun for those guys. They'll all agree to meet and they'll get together, and the first volunteer will drive the dog perhaps 50 or 100 miles, hand over to the next volunteer, and that will relay across country. And then there's also a lot of services here in the U.S. We often call them the puppy bus. For fairly inexpensive ticket, we can get the dog moved with an experienced handler cross country over the course of 2 or 3 days.
Mm. As you say, that's a wonderful camaraderie of people that love dogs getting together and helping this dog find a new home, isn't it?
It's terrific. And if it weren't for that, the resources just wouldn't be available through government agencies from taxation to do a lot of the work that's being done. So we rely very heavily on these folks, and there's so many people willing to give up their time, money, and put a lot of energy into rescuing dogs and seeing to it that we can continue to provide good rehab and rehome services that otherwise would never exist.
You've mentioned the website, and obviously there's a lot of news and, as you say, advice on there. The other thing I like is that you've got opportunities, you know, you highlight opportunities for people. Not only can you adopt a dog, but if you're not in that position, you could sponsor a dog, or there's sort of fostering opportunities, and there's fundraising. So there's lots and lots of ways that people can support dogs only, and indeed, you know, perhaps if they're not near enough to dogs only, their local shelters.
Absolutely, and of course, most people, no matter where they are in the world, if you just look a little harder, you're probably going to find a local rescue effort of some kind. And we would encourage people to do everything they can. It doesn't take a lot. Sometimes, perhaps, just showing up to help with an adoption showing. Other times, it might simply be going to the shelter, take a leash with you, and walk a dog. It makes a huge difference to that dog to get out of there and have a walk and get some fresh air. And, of course, there's always financial aid that can be provided. But by and large, what we really need is time and elbow grease. People are willing to come out and do a little bit of work, even if it's, again, if it's just walking a dog.
I think it's probably the best advice is show up and ask what needs to be done, isn't it?
Yes, and it's very satisfying. You get to know some of these dogs. At times, you know, when it's time for the dog to move on to a new home and you've got to say goodbye, that's tough. That's very difficult. But it's a very satisfying way to spend your time.
Now, obviously the website is available worldwide, so you've got a huge variety of people available to access that. And I gather that some of the feedback you get for your spay and neutering policy isn't always positive.
That's true. You typically, the feedback that you get, if it's not about a specific dog, is not always positive. I think people are motivated often to reply when they feel strongly about something. And when it comes to spay and neutering, we'll get a lot of feedback, in particular, I think, from visitors from the UK, that they feel spay and neutering is wrong, that it in some way might be harming the dogs. I think what people need to realize is that in our part of the world here, in the southern central part of the United States, we've got a lot of rural communities separated by these vast tracts of land. There's a prevailing attitude about dogs that means that spaying and neutering, it's either too expensive or that it in some way, you know, that it's harming the dog. So we have a lot of dogs that are able to breed in an uncontrolled way if it weren't for the fact that the rescue groups and humane societies were pushing spay and neutering. We would simply melt down under the sheer volume of dogs that are stray. We couldn't cope. So it's not a matter of convenience for us to do this. It's a matter of absolute necessity.
Mm.
If we weren't spaying or neutering, the numbers of dogs that would be dying in the streets, that would be suffering out in the streets in harsh weather conditions here, the number of dogs that would have to be euthanized because there's animal services in these rural communities are just not able to cope, those numbers would be astronomical.
Mm.
And so it's very important that we continue to spay and neuter the dogs. It's not a matter of deciding whether or not spaying and neutering makes a difference in terms of long-term health goals. It's a matter of necessity.
Mm. As you say, you've got to consider the right and the health implications and the happiness and all that of the extra dogs that you would be bringing in to an already overstretched situation. It just doesn't work, does it?
That's right. And you know, the weather environment here in Arkansas is extreme. In the summer, the temperature can routinely go to well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit
mm.
for several weeks at a time. In the winter, it can drop well below freezing.
Mm.
We suffer a lot from heartworm. A dog in the wild here not receiving heartworm medication is almost guaranteed to contract heartworm from mosquito bites within a matter of weeks.
Mm.
Parasites, fleas, ticks, these dogs are really going to suffer. So it's a proactive effort to get as many dogs spayed and neutered as possible and to try to educate the public that it makes a lot of sense for them to do the same.
Now, we've talked before about some of the cases that you remember, and you were saying that one that sticks, you know, very vividly in your memory is a dog called Selma or Bubbles.
That's right. Selma was, it's a long story, and in fact, you can still find Selma's story on the Dogs Only website, the Adoption Gallery. Her bio is still listed there. But to cut a long story short, Bubbles, as I call her, was shot by a breeder and left to die.
Oh.
Local Samaritans heard about this, went in and rescued her, and then transported her from Oklahoma about 250 miles to dogs only. When she arrived, she had been shot. Evidently, you could tell from the wound that she'd been sitting facing somebody, and they'd taken the gun and put it at her neck and pulled the trigger. The bullet passed through her body, came out of her side. Of course, severe injury on her shoulder on the way out. Now, what was bizarre was that we also discovered a cut that ran from one side of her chest to the other, a very deep cut, laceration. So she was in very poor condition. And matter of fact, the director of Dogs Only spent weeks and weeks literally bathing her wounds, irrigating the wounds, nursing her, providing pain medication for her until she was able to get up and start to move around again. And over time, as you work with some of these shot dogs and you see them do well and they come to depend on you, you develop a very strong bond with them. And in Selma's case, she was one for me that I became very attached with. And so when eventually she was adopted, I believe up into Minnesota, a long way north of here, it's very, very difficult, wrenching for me to see her go. That's very common. I often tell people if you're going to get into rescue, be prepared, because it's not all fun. There are times when it's very sad and very difficult. But it's nice to get emails and updates from the people that have adopted her.
Yeah, yeah. I think the thing is, when you, it's not just dogs, but I mean, when we've had baby rabbits and things that we've tried to help, and when you, as you say, when you work with an animal like that, you invest so much emotionally in their survival, and it becomes, it's not just, I mean, dog rescue, it's a touching subject anyway, but when you work with a specific animal like that, you really, really invest, and it becomes vital to you, doesn't it? And you, as you say, to see them go, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yes, it's very, very difficult. Then we had another one come through very recently who'd done poorly physically, and we got her in, rehabilitated her. Everybody bonded with her. We got very, very attached with her. But this particular dog was terrified of the slightest thing, smallest noise, any disturbance, strangers, even cats would terrify her, a huge dog. We eventually found a home that was willing to take with her and work with those issues out in California. Moved her out there, recently got an email from her new family with photographs showing her running around with other dogs, playing, no longer having any issues. So while it's often very hard to see these dogs go after you've become such good friends with them, it's tremendously satisfying when you hear back from the families that have adopted them to see how well they do.
Mm. And of course, it's wonderful then for the dog and for the people involved,
Absolutely.
Isn't it? The new family.
Everybody wins. Adoption, cats, dogs, rabbits, you know, hedgehogs, whatever. Adoption is a terrific way to bring a companion into your life.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we encountered Dogs Only website, and I've recommended it to people before, and I've told people the story about Rio, who was featured on your website, who was a very clever dog and would run the batteries down on her collar, wouldn't she, and escape over the wall and things like this. I mean, that was such a lovely... It was a bad situation that she was in, but she was such a clever dog. That was amazing.
She's incredible. And the thing about rescue is that after a few years, you fall into the false sense of security that you've seen everything. And then all of a sudden, somebody like Rio comes along. And Rio was smart enough to figure out that if she stood close to the perimeter and listened to the beep, eventually the beeping would stop, and she could then just simply walk straight through without any problems. So over and over again, dogs will more than often surprise you with just how smart and intelligent they can be. And Rio was adopted. She eventually found a home. And no matter how difficult it seems at times to get a dog adopted, if you wait long enough and you're patient, there's always a perfect home for every dog.
And she's doing well there, is she?
She's doing terrific. We stay in touch with them as much as is possible. And we get emails, we get phone calls. Oftentimes people will bring their dogs back to visit us at adoption showings. And Rio is doing extremely well. And again, Rio is still on the website. You can see her pictures.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, now, I thought I had my hands full with about 6 or 7 pounds of puppy that I'm dealing with at the moment. But you've got a puppy in... I mean, you've got several puppies, but you were telling me about one particular puppy, Duke.
Yeah.
who's a bit more of a handful than that. Can you tell us about
him? Duke is an amazing puppy. He's a Great Pyrenees mix, I believe Anatolian Shepherd, predominantly with some Great Pyrenees. We got a phone call from an elderly couple in north central Arkansas pleading with us to please come and take some dogs from them that they had got toward the latter half of last year. So we went to visit and took a look at these two, and we discovered in particular one little puppy who weighed 110 pounds and was still only 10 months old.
Good grief.
Known as Duke, and we think that the reason they needed to release him for rehome was that he was simply getting to the point where physically they couldn't cope with Duke jumping up on their laps.
Oh.
So we took Duke in, and we've been spending some time with him. And it's remarkable to go over there, and at first you're startled by his sheer size. But then all of a sudden, Duke will start to romp about and jump just like you would expect to see a 6 or 8 or 10-pound puppy. It's really funny to watch him. So Duke is yet another. We don't take a lot of puppies into dogs only. We try to focus on the dogs that are harder to adopt. But from time to time, we'll get them in, and of course, Duke, you know, is the perfect match for us. Huge. And playful, and a puppy.
Because I've been looking on your website, and there's a lot of Anatolians and Anatolian crosses, aren't there?
Yeah. There's a couple of reasons for that, but the main one is that particular breed has become very popular with farmers in rural communities in the southern part of the United States. The breed's originally from Turkey, where they were bred to guard sheep and goats, and so farmers in rural communities here learned about this about 10 years ago and started bringing them over in numbers. So now, unfortunately, there are breeders and there are also a lot of dogs that have come from the original stock that are in need of rehome. And it's a little more difficult to get a large dog adopted. I mean, you've got to look a little bit further to find a family willing to take a dog that large. And you also want to find a family that's able to deal with it with large dogs. You know, you wouldn't necessarily want to bring one into an apartment or a flat where you don't have space for them. So it's a little more difficult, but the reason that we have them is because farmers are now using them in the southern part of the United States as protection for their livestock.
I suppose like many breeds, popularity brings as many problems as advantages, doesn't it?
That's true. And unfortunately, for example, there'll be a film or movie released that might feature a dog, particular breed. Or you'll see a famous personality carrying a dog around, and then within a year or so, all of a sudden they start showing up on the doorstep of rescue. So that's another trend that tends to cause problems and bloat the numbers that are coming in the doors.
Well, Peter, it sounds like you're doing a really great job. You know, you're fighting many a battle on many fronts there with many problems. The best of luck with all the brilliant work that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Julie.
The Dogs Only website has some great information for anyone interested in dogs, and there's a link to it on the Dogcast site, along with links to the stories of some of the dogs Peter talked about. Through the hard work of people like Peter and organisations like Dogs Only, many dogs' lives have been transformed, and the website also has ideas for ways you can help support this vital work.
Hello, and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News Desk. I'm Nick.
And I'm Kate. Do you remember that English dog who hit the news when he ate the microchip that started his owner's car?
Ah, yes. That's the one who ensured he was taken out everywhere because she couldn't start the car without him.
Well, it seems he isn't alone in the habit of making a meal of unusual things. In Gloucester, England, a 6-month-old Labrador puppy recently found himself well and truly in the doghouse when he chomped through 800 pounds. His disastrous dinner included a cheque for £440, £360 in cash, and his owner's credit cards.
That's bad enough, but our next doggy diner really bit off more than he could chew. What would you think if your dog rattled when he walked? Well, that's just what happened to one UK dog. When vets x-rayed Barney, the Springer Spaniel, his stomach was shown to contain 6 stones, 2 twigs, and 2 small apples, too. After an operation to remove the unwanted objects, Barney is fine, and his family have the stones on display as a souvenir of his brush with disaster.
Leon, the Bull Mastiff, is another dog who survived eating a dangerous object. On a fishing trip with his family, Leon managed to gulp down a fishing hook. Although the fishing line was left sticking out of his mouth, the hook had been swallowed. X-rays showed the hook lodged in Leon's stomach, and vets operated. Amazingly, Leon was none the worse for his adventure.
That reminds me of the story in our last news of the couple who managed to reel in a lost terrier on their fishing trip. I know anglers have a reputation for tall tales, but this next story might be a bit hard to swallow. We've all heard of the excuse that my dog ate my homework, but did you hear about the woman in Iowa who claimed her dog ate her winning lottery ticket? Unsurprisingly, she hasn't received a payout yet.
We know it's dangerous to throw sticks for our dogs, and here's an example of why. When Millie the Staffordshire Bull Terrier attempted to retrieve a stick, things went wrong, and poor Millie swallowed the stick. Now, bearing in mind that Millie is an 18-inch long dog, and the stick she swallowed was around 16 inches, her owner feared she would die. However, vets were able to remove the stick, and all Millie suffered was a small scratch inside her stomach.
It seems there is no end to the life-threatening items dogs can get hold of, and another 18-inch dog managed to swallow a 15-inch long knife. The Collie Staffordshire Bull Terrier cross puppy was fine once vets had removed the knife. A St. Bernard pup in Florida also survived swallowing a 13-inch knife. The knife remained inside the dog for around 4 days until owners realised there was a problem and vets operated.
Dogs obviously enjoy variety in their diet, and in Turkey, a man was astonished to discover his dog had eaten his phone. How did he find out? Well, when he dialed his own number in an attempt to locate the phone, he could hear it ringing from inside his dog. Nature took its course, and the phone eventually re-emerged.
I'm not sure he'll ever want to use that again. And the same could be said of the digital camera, eaten and passed by another dog, and the baby bottle nipple swallowed by a Lhasa Apso. One dog owner tried to claim on his insurance for an operation to remove a conker from his dog's stomach.
We all know dogs, and most humans, dislike choke chains. But one young dog took extreme measures to get rid of the dreaded item. Yes, you've guessed it. He swallowed the offending 16-inch long chain. Once vets had surgically removed it, it ended up where it belongs, in the trash.
And finally, one thing that most dogs seem to eat is grass. And do you know why?
Well, we've certainly heard a lot of theories on the subject. But tell us, what's the answer?
Well, to be honest, no one actually knows for sure. But I guess as long as your dog is on a quality diet and shows no other symptoms, eating grass should not be dangerous for them. And certainly is a lot safer than any of the other items in this report. Goodbye.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com. Now, are you a fan of pedigrees, or are you a devotee of the crossbreed? There are many theories on which is best, some fact, some fiction, but at Aberdeen University in Scotland, Dr. David Smith and his team have been studying canine intelligence. Researchers investigated the IQ of a variety of crossbreeds and pedigrees with a view to finding out which were cleverer. I spoke to David about the research and the intriguing results.
Yeah, we had a small student project running where the student was testing, giving different dogs simple tests to do to compare which were more intelligent to either crossbreds or purebreds. And the idea of this was to see whether we could perhaps use crossbreds for roles that have traditionally been the preserve of purebred animals, such as, you know, police dogs or guide dogs for the blind, etc.
Mm-hmm. And presumably, are there more crossbreeds around for that purpose?
Obviously, specific dogs tend to be put towards certain roles. For instance, you often see Labradors doing and Golden Retrievers doing guide dog work and things. But we thought, you know, if we could test the dog's attitude and character rather than just rely on its breed, then we might be able to select dogs from, say, dogs' homes or sanctuaries and find a role for them, so there would be a wider job for them in their communities.
Mm, which would be excellent, wouldn't it?
Yeah. The other issue is that because purebreds tend to be highly selected, they often suffer from genetic diseases such as hip dysplasia or deafness or things like that. So the more you breed these animals, the greater the risk is of that. So if we could use crossbreeds, we can remove that problem as well.
And so what was the testing process? What did that involve?
It was just a simple set of tests, really, where the owner would, for instance, hide things under the couch to see if the dog had the wit to retrieve it. Or maybe if you hid a ball, the dog's favourite ball, under a bucket or a bowl or something, if the dog could turn the bucket over or to find the ball and things like that.
And what kind of different crossbreeds did you have?
Well, we had a whole range. We had 88 dogs in all, and we got to about 30 different breeds. But we got lots of spaniels, lots of collies, lots of terriers, and lots of crossbreds of all those three types of dogs.
And what sort of results did you get?
Well, we found that purebred collies in the test that we ran were the brightest, as you could probably guess. But all the other breeds, if they were crossbred of those breeds, they tended to perform better than the purebred breeds. So the crossbred spaniels performed better than the purebred spaniels, and the crossbred terriers performed better than the purebred terriers. So that little bit of different blood in them seemed to improve their performance in these tests.
So, because as you say, there is this hybrid vigour, isn't there?
Yeah.
Crossbreeding, we've known for a while, sort of helps lessen the risk of the physical illnesses or conditions they might suffer from.
Yeah.
So would that indicate that it can help with mental ability as well?
Possibly. I mean, what I suspect is happening is that if a spaniel's got a bit of collie in it, which is giving it the intellect, that shows through in the crossbred. So what I'm thinking is that certain breeds have a bigger influence on the resultant crossbreed than others. So that sort of means that the puppy is more intelligent than half of the parents, if you see what I mean. That's what you mean by hybrid vigor, is that you've got a better result than half of the parents. So we're thinking that including a certain breed within a crossbred could have the desired effect.
So it's not just a case of a crossbreed then. It there is still an influence of the original.
Yeah, I mean, what, just like sheep farmers have preferences for certain crossbreeds. For instance, a sheep farmer will cross a black-faced sheep with a Leicester to get a mother that's hardy, who's good at rearing lambs as well. We are thinking maybe we could have a set of recognised crossbreeds that were as good at doing jobs as the traditional purebred animals.
One common mix, which is almost regarded as a breed these days, is the Labradoodle. Did you test any of those?
Oh, yeah. No, we didn't get any of those. No, they're becoming very popular. But I've seen a couple in the park, but we didn't have any tests on those.
Yeah, yeah. I'm told that they are very intelligent with the Labrador and the Poodle mix.
Yeah, I've heard that the guide dogs use those now for actual training. So I think that's sort of the strength of that crossbreed is well recognised, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So will you be looking at this any more in the future, or have you made any recommendations to for example, the sniffer dogs or the guide dogs or anything like that?
Well, the next phase is, this is a very small study, so we've got two subsequent studies that we're going to do. One is testing whether we can make our dogs more intelligent by feeding them things like fish oil. So we're working with a company called Dodson Horrell down in the south of England to test whether, if we get those omega-3s into the diet, the dogs become brighter. And the other thing we're doing is we're hoping to get a project going with the guide dogs to see if we can test some guide dogs to see how they perform on these tests and compare them to the sort of general population that we've already done.
So the fish oil experiment or study, will that involve sort of testing, feeding and retesting, or...?
Yeah, I mean, we'd like to keep everything very straightforward and not very high tech. So we'll just recruit some owners. Maybe you can help us with that. That the cool tester will basically carry out these set of intelligence tests before they feed the fish oil, and then maybe feed them for 4 or 5 weeks with the supplement, and then see if the dog's any brighter at the end of those tests.
With the fish oil study, presumably there's no sort of side effects with the fish oils for the dogs?
No, we're going to not give the dog very much. You know, just you know, obviously with oils, there could be some effect on gut function. So we don't want to give them too much. We just want to give them that boost of omega-3s that is said to improve concentration span and things like that in humans. So we don't want to, you know, give the dogs a run or anything.
No, certainly not. But, I mean, and presumably as well, it might have a benefit for the dog in terms of skin and coat condition.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we occasionally give our dogs fish oil to you know, when they're to improve their coat and joints and things. But again, just in small quantities. I mean, it's just basically the sort of thing you would buy from the pet shop anyway that you'd use in moderation.
Mm. Now, do people have to physically come to the university with their dog?
No, it's all based on, you know, doing it in your living room. All the tests are very simple, straightforward, and the idea is not to stress the animal out or to stress the owner out at all. So it's all fun. If the animal does get stressed, we ask the owners to stop and not continue, because obviously some dogs just won't participate in these tests. They just don't think it's funny. So.
Yes. They don't want to be assessed, thank you.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. So wherever anybody is in the world, they could participate in this study?
Maybe the fish oil one would be difficult around the world, but it would certainly be because we'd have to send the fish oil out. But anybody in the UK could participate in that, I think.
So anybody in the UK could participate in the fish oil? And so the IQ testing, though, is that finished now?
No, we're going to... every year our students do, the fourth year students do a project, so the fourth years that are starting now are going to start looking at the data and doing a few more tests. So we've got one girl who's hopefully doing it with guide dogs, another one that's going to do this fish oils, and another one I think she was going to do it with police dogs because her dad is a policeman. So if people want to partake in the survey, I can certainly send them details. And they can send us the results without any problem.
It sounds really interesting. As I say, this is it's quite a heartfelt area, this pedigree versus crossbreed. You know, there's some very strong feelings about that.
There is. We almost split up a few marriages where the wife had a purebred and the husband had a crossbred, and we were trying to prove which one was the best.
But no divorce cases yet.
Not yet. Not I know of. No.
If you'd like to get involved in either of those studies, there's a link to the Aberdeen University site on the Dogcast site. And now, 2-Minute Fiction, Water Baby, written by Julie Hill, read by Nick Coldham.
I share my space with a Leonberger, and what a lot of space he takes up. If you don't know what a Leonberger looks like, picture Chewbacca, the Wookiee from Star Wars, walking on all fours, and you won't be far off. His name is Charlie, and his, well, I suppose he's my best friend, really. Of course, he's also the best dog in the world. Great fun, brilliant listener, everything you want in a dog. He's well-trained and very well-socialised. You can't mess around with a dog this big. There is one thing that frightens him, though. Water. Leonbergers are supposed to love the water, but Charlie can't stand it. He tries, he paddles tentatively, running away quickly if the slightest wave of water approaches him. But he won't let the water get higher than his lower legs, and he will definitely never swim. We walk him every morning around a local lake, and although I throw sticks and stones out to tempt him, he refuses to go in. The big fool stands there, looking at me, wagging his big fluffy tail, not budging an inch. At first, I used to throw toys out, but that got too expensive when someone else's dog claimed them. Well, they were no use to us anyway. So we stand by the lake's edge, me still vainly trying to tempt him to wade in. I've even paddled out myself when the weather's warm enough. And every morning he stays resolutely dry. Also, every morning, the same dog and her owner walk past us. I smile as Charlie sadly watches the other dog trot quickly past. I swear he fancies her. She's a big white standard poodle, and Charlie's eyes get this sad look every time she passes. She never comes over. Charlie did set out towards her once, but I called him back. The dog's owner and I nod our greetings, but that's as far as it's gone. The poodle never shows any interest in us. Straight past they go, while my big lump of a waterphobic, love-struck dog and I stand there. It was strange how we got to meet finally, and not how I would have wanted, but Charlie was finally happy. It was a winter's morning, a really cold one, and I was walking briskly to get the walk over and done with. There's a wooden jetty I sometimes walk out on with Charlie. The lake is so beautiful, and although Charlie doesn't want to swim, he does enjoy watching the birds and spotting the occasional fish. So there we were, and I threw a stick out for Charlie. I knew he wouldn't fetch it, but I can't quite give up on him. He watched the stick splash, bob, and float, and looked at me as if to say, "That was fun, throw another." So I picked up another and decided to throw it with as much energy as I could, showing off to my dog. Sad, I know. I pulled my arm back and flung it forward with all my might. I never got to see it land, though, as I lost my balance from the effort of the throw. The wood beneath my feet was wet and slippy. I flailed my arms around like a comedy tightrope walker, but to no avail, and gravity won the battle as I toppled gracelessly forwards into the lake. I can swim, of course, but boy, that water was cold. It took my breath away, and I bobbed about, panicking. Charlie jumped and barked, clearly worried about me. I could see him dancing about on the jetty, wanting to come and get me, but too scared. I'd love to tell you that Charlie screwed up his courage, jumped in, splashed out, and saved my life. I'd love to tell you that, but I can't, because it's not what happened. I was trying to swim, but my heavy winter clothes were weighing me down, and the intense cold was making my bones ache and numbing my hands and feet. I knew I was in trouble if I didn't get out fast. I called to Charlie, but I just swallowed a mouthful of lake water. Suddenly, there was a flash of white past Charlie and an explosion of water upwards. Then something was splashing out towards me. It was the poodle. The snooty poodle that snubbed us daily was coming to save me. She reached me and started nudging me towards the jetty, while I ineffectually splashed and gasped. When I got near enough, Charlie started nosing at me, which didn't really help, but the poodle's owner got hold of my hand, and with some embarrassing pulling and heaving between us, we got me out of the cold water. I took off my sodden coat, and the poodle's owner gave me his coat to wrap around me. It turns out that the poodle, her name's Chloe, isn't snooty. She's just had a sad past. She was mistreated, and she's wary of people. Luckily for me, she has absolutely no fear of water, unlike Charlie. What a pair, one afraid of water, the other of people. Since that day, we still see the poodle and her person every day, but now we all stop and have a chat. Some days we do the whole walk together. The dogs love it, they get on so well. You know, it's funny, and you can say I'm imagining it if you like, but I don't care. I'm sure that they're trying to help each other with their fears. Chloe bounds into the water and frolics around barking sharply, and gradually Charlie is going out further towards her every day. He's obviously head over heels in love, and will only do this when she's there. For his part, Charlie, who's always been friendly, wags his tail at everyone, looking over his shoulder to Chloe as if to say, "Come on, it's all right, I'll look after you." I'm not sure if it's working, but Charlie keeps trying, and he's slowly turning from water baby into a water baby.
If you were a dog breed, what dog breed would you be, and why? I think I would probably be something like a Newfoundland. Long hair, big, enjoys swimming, and protective of her pack. I always tell my husband he is like an Irish wolfhound, because he is very easygoing, very loyal, immensely strong when necessary, but slightly scruffy-looking. If you have a good idea for what breed you would be, or even an idea for a celebrity, let us know. Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121 288 0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 441-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
What do you get when you cross a dog with a phone? A golden receiver.